Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
I first met Savannah Guthrie in 2008 when she joined the Obama campaign press corps, assigned there by NBC News. She went on to become their White House correspondent during the 2 years that I served there. And I learned two things about her. One is that she's very, very smart. And the other is she's a very genuine and honest person. Those qualities have contributed to her success as an anchor of the Today Show. I caught up with Savannah in New York recently to talk about her very interesting life, career, and this moment in journalism and politics. Savannah Guthrie, my old friend, it's great to see you again.
Good to see you in your new palatial digs. Good to see you as a returning member of the media,
yes.
David. I don't forget that you were once a reporter.
You know, I'm proud of that. I was raised in journalism, and I'm proud of that. Speaking of being raised, let's talk about your family. Born in Australia.
Yes.
Why?
I'm a U.S. citizen. I was born in Australia because my
dad
was...
Just in case you run for president.
Exactly.
We don't want to get into that again.
No, we won't. But by the way... I think it's never been litigated. I think, am I a natural born citizen? The case has never come up to the court.
We'll get to your law stuff later.
Okay. I'm like, oh, fascinating. No, I was born in Australia because my father was in the mining business. And he, at that point, in the early 70s, had been transferred there to work for a company. So our family lived there for about 2 years. And I happened to be born during that time. And not until I started working for the Today Show had I been back in all of these years. And one of the best things about this job is like all the cool stuff you get to do. And they sent me to Australia with my mom.
Oh,
and we found the very hospital room where I was born and the midwives who basically delivered me.
Wow.
Yeah. I really grew up in Arizona via Australia.
And tell me about your folks.
My dad, first of all, he passed away when I was 16.
I know.
He grew up in Kentucky in Harlan County. So that's like the real deal southeastern coal country. His family came up from Alabama and basically started that little town, as I understand it. You never know how much of your family lore is true, but here's how we tell it in our family. And they started a family mine. And his father, who also died in his 20s, ran the mine with his brother, and the Guthries were all there and all over Harlan County. And then...
not related to Woody.
Well, aren't we all related in some sense? No, I always want to pretend that I'm related to those Woody and Arlo Guthrie, so I say I really shouldn't talk about that. But no known relation that I'm aware of. Because, of course, I have guitar aspirations, so it would be great if I could claim some.
Yes, we're going to reserve the last 15 minutes for that.
No, then it'll be like people will be dialing out. he grew up in coal country, and then he met my mom on a blind date at the University of Kentucky. She was a city girl. She grew up in northern Kentucky in Fort Wright, which is near Covington, which is right across the river from Cincinnati.
What did her family, what's their story?
Yeah, so her dad was actually a lawyer, her mom was a homemaker. My grandma was the youngest of like 12 kids, Margaret Ann McDermott, good Catholics. And she grew up in, like I said, in northern Kentucky, but almost like a suburb of Cincinnati, right across the river. And she went to the University of Kentucky for school, studied journalism. And they met on a blind date at a UK basketball game. And my mom, the other like big thing that mattered to my mom and ultimately to us too, is she had an older brother who had Down syndrome,
yeah.
Uncle Pierce. And he was a big, important figure in her life and my life too.
How did that impact you?
Well, we grew up with Uncle Pierce. He was like our favorite uncle, which we would guiltily say, like, sorry, Uncle Bud, you're not our favorite uncle. It's Uncle Pierce because he was such a delight, you know, and to little kids, like, we didn't think or know that there was anything different about him. But of course, as we got older, we saw that, you know, that he was different. And I think it just was incredibly important because, first of all, as a kid, you know, it's probably the first time I realized, you know, how other people have struggles. You know, it kind of like takes you outside yourself.
Yeah.
I can remember once they used to come to visit us a lot in Arizona when I was, you know, in elementary school. And I remember once he loved to play basketball. And I remember we would go up to my elementary school and like he'd kind of play on the courts, but he could never throw a ball like, you know, the way a normal, I shouldn't say normal, as though most of us can throw. He did it. He swung his arms up from under, like underhand a ball. Mm-hmm. And it was really adorable. And he just loved doing it. And I remember he was doing that. And I was actually playing off on the playground. And some kids who didn't know it was my uncle were like, what is that guy doing? Is he retarded or something? Mm-hmm. And I just will never forget how crushing it was. And also kind of this moment of truth, like, do I admit that's my uncle?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And
that's such a hard thing. You know, I have a child now, an adult, who has intellectual disabilities and lots of struggles. And I remember one of my boys was playing basketball when he was in middle school and got into an argument with somebody on the court, and the other kid said, well, at least I don't have a retarded sister. And you know, when you're 12 or 11 or whatever he was at the time, you don't know how to deal with that. He was enraged and a fight ensued, but all kinds of complicated feelings about that. It does shape you.
It does. I mean, I remember I honestly don't remember if I said, hey, that's my uncle, or I didn't. I just know I remember the struggle in my own mind, like wanting to say, that's my uncle, don't say that, but also just wanting to blend in, because any kid ever wants to do is just be normal.
Right.
Like, you know, I wished my name was Bridget or Denise, not Savannah. Like, why did I have to have this stupid, different name that no one had?
Such a cool name.
And now I like it. But, you know, as a kid, it was like you'd go to the Safeway and they'd have those little keychains or license plates. It was the 70s with the rainbow. And it'd be like, Amy, Jennifer. And I'm like, there's never a Savannah. So, you know, all is to say, it's a tangent. But, you know, we as kids, we just want to blend in. We don't know how to be different.
And you mentioned your mom studied journalism, and she continued to study journalism in Arizona.
Yeah.
And did you know from an early age that that's what you wanted to do?
Not at all. I mean, in elementary school, I was like, I think I was a decent kid. But in high school, I was kind of a slacker. You know, I wasn't a terrible kid, but I was not highly motivated. And the 80s, that particular part, that 1985 to 1989 were like such a difficult time in our whole larger family. I mean, first of all, my father died in 1988.
Yeah, tell me about that. You know, I lost my dad at an early age. Tell me how this was a complete shock, right?
Yes. I think that's why we always connected, you know, because those of us who've lost a parent young, we all know each other in some sense. But he had a heart attack, and I was 16.
He was in his 40s.
He was 49.
Yeah.
It's crazy for me to think about, first of all, I'm 46 now. That's how old my mother was, you know, which, you know, when you're a kid, you're like, oh, well, she's in her 40s. Now I think that that's such a young age, and she had three kids, and she hadn't worked outside the home. At all. She had been a stay-at-home. Even though she'd gotten her degree, she had always stayed at home. So I can't even imagine her terror at losing her husband and then having my oldest brother in college, my sister and I both in high school, and she's looking around going, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
You know, so she's incredible. But, yeah.
Do you remember, not to pry, but the moment that you got that news?
Yeah, of course. I can still see it, you know. It was a Friday night, and I had been out with friends, and I walked in the front door, and the light, I could see, we had sort of like a foyer, kind of, sounds fancy, just a room before the main living room, and there were some doors that you could kind of see through. And what I remember about is walking in the front door and immediately noticing the lights were on. Usually all the lights wouldn't be on because we were supposed to have a midnight curfew, come in and say, Mom and Dad, we're home. And that was it. They didn't stay up, wait for us. But I looked through and I saw my sister and my mom sitting on the couch with their heads bowed. And I knew in that second something was wrong. It was like in the air, you know? And to me, I can still see, I started to walk in, they started to walk forward to me, and I just knew something awful had happened. I mean, it just was like, and I started to say, no, 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 no. And my mom just said it really fast, Dad died. And I mean, it makes me cry to think about it. I haven't talked about it in a long time. I just screamed.
Yeah.
I just screamed. It just was, what I really remember saying almost right away was, but we still need him.
Yeah.
Because when you're 16, you kind of think you're just about grown up.
Yeah.
You know, and you don't have that like compassion for yourself to say like, oh, you're just a kid. You still need your dad. You know, you think, I remember thinking like, I shouldn't be that upset because I had him almost till I was 18. And that's when you're adult. So like, I was really only entitled to 18 years and I got 16. So, you know, and that's kind of how I was like, so you should be happy that you had those 16 years. But that was my first thought. We still need him.
Yeah. You know, I just was talking about this with someone the other day who was asking me about it. And I said that was when I got the news that my dad had died, that was the line of demarcation between my childhood and my adulthood.
Yeah.
Because I was so, he was sort of the rock for me. And when he was gone, I said, okay, you're on your own now. My mom and I were sort of estranged. You obviously were close to your mom.
But how old were you when your dad died?
19.
Yeah. And so, it is that, it's a strange time because yeah. You put all that on yourself like you're supposed to be grown up because yeah. All teenagers think they're grown up. You know, they don't know that they're not, and they still need their parents, and they're always going to need their parents.
Now you and you've talked about this, that how faith was important to you in getting through that, and generally in your family. Tell me about that.
Yeah, we had a very I hate the word religion, although it was sort of religious. I mean, we had a very faithful household. You know, my parents when they met weren't religious at all. My dad, you know, he grew up in a place where they were all Protestants, and they had like, he would talk about like in Harlan County, you know, there were like Pentecostal churches where there were like the snake charmers and stuff. Like they passed the snake, and if the snake bit you, that meant like the devil was in you and all kinds of like really wild stuff.
That's rough.
Yeah, from like the 30s and 40s. Yeah. So he had no, and he was like, he had some wild living. You know, my father was a drinker. He had gotten in like 10 car accidents before he was 25. Mm. I mean, he was a wild one. And then he met my mom. I think she thinks she kind of saved his life by calming him down. And my mom grew up Catholic, but she had really not, as a young person, was just kind of, she thought the Catholics were too rigid. Neither one of them were particularly religious. And the way she tells it is that when I was about 4 or 5 years old, or maybe a little younger, 3, my father looked at all of us. I was the youngest and was like, do you think like we should get these kids in church or something? Like, shouldn't they believe in something? And so they found this church, and it was a Baptist church in Tucson, Arizona. And I remember very well my dad telling me the story of one time he was sitting there listening to the sermon. And it was one of those Baptist churches where they always at the end of every service, there's like, they call it an invitation where they say, like, if you feel the Spirit talking to you, come forward and someone will pray with you. And my dad talked about how he's like, I had no idea what I was doing, but I found myself walking to the front of the church. And he had this like redemption experience. And, you know, it didn't make him perfect after that at all. In fact, like one of the most defining attributes my father had was like this weighing awareness of his own sin and his own failings as a human.
He also must have borne the scars of losing his own father in his 20s.
Yeah, definitely. And his mom. I mean, they're just like, he's like a whole podcast in and of itself. But that changed so much for him. And then by extension, all of us. And so that was when I was pretty young. And I can remember seeing my parents get baptized.
Hmm.
You know, like in Baptist church, like they dunk you under. Right. Like I can remember it, and I was little. And so we grew up in that church, and we were for a while like very churchy. We would go Sunday morning, then Sunday school, then go home, have lunch, come back, Sunday night service and choir practice, and Wednesday night. So, you know, everything was set up for me to like not ever want to go to church again, because that's just way too much church.
Yeah.
But we were, my sister always says, God was the sixth member of our family. And I actually think that's very a nice way to put it, and a very truthful way to put it, and something I hope to emulate, because we all had a really abiding feeling of that God loved us, and that we were in a family with God. And I have had different and wavering phases of faithfulness, but ultimately it's always been like at my core, like the most important thing. And I feel I couldn't have done anything in my life to this day without that strong faith and like knowledge of God, that he's here, that he's good, that he loves me in spite of all rationale, you know? And
so you must have had that moment when your dad passed away of saying, why would, if God is good and loving, why would this be visited on me?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think lots of different things are faith shakers, and that was one of them. Although at that time, it was like I couldn't have the luxury of doubting my faith, because I needed it so badly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I needed so badly to pray. I needed so badly to turn to God, because my mom, while being a solid rock, like did not have the emotional capacity, I think, at that time to really comfort us. Like, you know, she got it done. She was rock solid. She was incredible. I marvel at her. She's made everything possible for all of us. But it's like,
can we sit there and share our feelings,
I want to cry all day? No, she couldn't let herself cry.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's another reason why it's like, I just had to, you have a choice at that point. It's like, you can leave God, but it's like, man, no, God, don't leave me now. Like, I need you more than ever. So in some ways, it's also a faith strengthener. Just over the years, it's just been really important.
So, you know, it's interesting to hear you speak about it, because we're sitting here in New York City in sort of the citadel of the elite.
Yes.
And it's not fashionable. I mean, this is one of the big divides in our country.
I know. I'm like the weirdo Bedirdo at every New York dinner party. People are like, whoa, one of those. It's an evangelical Christian. Come on over here. Let's talk to her. You know, and I guess I'm older now and I'm not the little kid I used to be. I'm happy to talk about it and if people are curious.
Yeah. But it is striking how how divided we are in that way.
Yeah.
And how unaccepting, you know... You know, I talk all the time about the silos that we live in, and, you know, this is one of those silos. And when they come and examine you like Margaret Mead would, how do people accept and intuit? And
well, you know, I find most people are really, I mean, there's a certain curiosity, but I haven't experienced happily condescension, which I think I might assume people would be like, well, that's nice. Well, we all need a crutch, or we all need a thing. I think there's like genuine curiosity about it. I have a friend through Mike, is how I've come to know him, Brian
Mike
Koppelman.
Feldman, your husband.
Yeah, Mike Feldman, my husband, and he grew up with this guy, Brian Koppelman, who also has a podcast and writes Billions and has been really successful. And he's an adorable example. He is a dyed-in-the-wool atheist or agnostic. But he really respects my faith and is very curious about it in like the most genuine way. Like, yeah. Tell me about that. Yeah, I want to know. Why do you think that? And not in the way of like you see in your college dorm room when people are like trying to win an argument,
yeah.
You know, or trying to be in the debate team or trying to say like, well, how come the Bible contradicts itself here and there? You know, like there's so many theological questions, all of those things. I don't mean to make it a cop out, but if I talk about my faith, I'm talking about something really personal. And I think it is intellectual. I do not think it's inconsistent with your intelligence, your intellect, knowledge, academics. But I do think it's ultimately visceral. Yeah. It's faith.
Well, yes, you have to take a leap.
You do?
That's why they call it a leap of faith.
Yes, it does. It's like that final step will be.
Yeah.
So I actually like it. I wish I, so yes, in some ways, I'm like, I feel like an ambassador.
Mike must be, yeah, I know. It shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be
but
that
I wish
way.
That more people would talk about it. I mean, like you had Anna Maria Cox on,
yes.
On your podcast, which I listened to and told you I was really an admirer of the whole conversation. But, you know, she's somebody who became a Christian and I don't know her at all. But when I read that, I reached out to her because I felt like, hey, I kind of understand the world you're living in. And, you know, I just wanted to say, like, you're not alone.
And she, I mean, her story is so compelling because she's had a lot of struggles in her life with mental illness and substance abuse. And, you know, faith has been a bulwark for her in dealing with those. So, you know, yeah, she was very compelling. So Mike, I just assume he's Jewish.
He is.
Yeah. And so how do you work that out with your kids?
Well, it's a really good question. It's one of the things that really preoccupied me in our long, long, protracted dating career. I think we dated for like 6 years because we were both.
That's a big investment. I'm glad it worked out.
Me too. Believe me, my mom was like, just let me know if anything happens. Like, you know, when you're first dating someone and you go on, like, you're like, oh, we're going on a weekend trip. When you come back, all your girlfriends are like, so?
Yeah.
We had dated so long, everybody'd be like, oh, you have a good time. You know, like by the time we finally got engaged, people were like, what? No. Yeah. Even I was surprised. I actually broke up with him on the day we got engaged, but that's another story. Anyway, so yes, that was one of the things we talked a lot about because, you know, he of course is Jewish and his culture and is extremely important to him. And he doesn't, I think he would say he doesn't consider himself particularly religious, but so we are raising them in both. So they're aware of their heritage. But one thing I did say, and he agrees, is that when you're talking about little kids, you're not throwing a religious studies seminar. Like I can't tell my 18-month-old or my 3-year-old about like the great religions of the world. They're too little for that.
Yeah.
And I feel very strongly because my faith is important to me that I want to tell them about the God that I know. I want them to make friends with God because I know if I were to die too young as my father did, I want them to have a friend to carry them through life as I did. I feel
Do you
that
worry
responsibility.
About that?
Not really. I think I'm like reasonably healthy, but I'm not unaware of the possibility. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, and I'm an older mom, you know, and so I do think about that too. You know, like I didn't have my first baby till I was 41.
Yeah.
So basically he agrees and I'm kind of teaching them faith. They come to church with me every Sunday. You know, it's hilarious when my daughter burst into Jesus Loves Me when we were celebrating Hanukkah one year, which was amazing. And Mike's parents are the best. And they were like, they were applauding they just love their grandkids so much. And, you know, there will come a time, as there comes a time in any person's life, when it is theirs to choose, who is God? Do I believe in God? Like, what is going to be my relationship with God? Is there even a God? I want to raise kids who can have that conversation.
Yeah.
They'll
have their own.
Yes.
Experience. But
and I don't believe
be
God's afraid of our questions or our doubt, you know, and that's the kind of children I hope to raise. But I'm going to teach them about Jesus. I'm going to teach them Jesus loves you. And then we'll see. I'll let him take it from there.
We started down the road to journalism and you went to University of Arizona. What was it your mom's influence or what caused you to head in that direction?
Well, David, how do I put this? I really didn't have any options because I was a high school slacker. I had terrible grades. I never even thought about where I was going.
Let me just interject something. I read somewhere that you didn't have a date to the prom.
I didn't really like, it was like one of those classic high school deals. Like, no one asked me to the prom, but I had a job and there was like a guy who was like a part-time construction worker. And I was like, do you want to go to the prom? He was like 19. I was probably 17. And then maybe we kind of went, but I don't think we ever went in. So yeah, I didn't have a date to the prom.
Yeah. I was wondering, you know, there's that Toby Keith song called How Do You Like Me Now? And I'm wondering if you think about all the people who didn't ask you to the prom,
oh,
watching you on the Today Show and thinking, my God. I had no idea.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, like if I'm like proof that high school losers can actually, it's better to not peak in high school. Don't you think? It's better to
absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but I always had friends, thankfully, but I wasn't like particularly attractive or anything. And I don't think boys really liked me for a long time. Really, for a long time. I mean, I don't know. It's complicated. You know how high school is.
Yes. I have a vague recollection. It was a while ago now.
Me too.
So, so you really didn't know what you wanted to do?
Not at all. So I was kind of just like lazing through high school. I had a 2.5 GPA. I had 35 unexcused absences my last year in high school because I was always like ditching to go
cutting
cigarettes all the time. Mm-hmm. Ridiculous. And my mom, you know, my dad had just died. So I think my mom, it's like she knew, but she didn't know. She was just like, she was trying to survive. So she didn't have time to like ride herd on that. So I remember I took the SAT. I didn't study for it. I remember kind of being like, oh, the SAT's tomorrow. Yeah, I got to go take that test. So I did okay. And so, and by the way, I loved the University of Arizona, but it was my school that I lived that was in my town. And I didn't even live, I mean, we really couldn't afford to live in the dorms. You know, my mom was like, look, I can pay for your school. You know, I want you to, I'll do that, but you have to live at home. I can't pay for an apartment mm-hmm. for you or your sister. So we lived at home. Mm-hmm. And that also was kind of good because we were trying to all be together and take care of her too.
Yeah.
My sister and I had this little pact all through college. My mom never knew about it. You know, if it's Friday night, one of us goes out, one stays with mom. Saturday night, one goes out. So we would just trade. Like, could I have Saturday night this weekend?
So when you graduated, you got a job that lasted all of 10 days in Butte, Montana.
Yes, you did your research.
At a TV station.
Yes.
Was it hard to leave your mom?
Yes. Yeah. And yeah,
we should explain in a minute why it lasted 10 days. It wasn't because of you, but.
No, yes, thankfully.
Yes.
I know. But yes, it was hard because I had lived at home all that time. I was very, very, very attached to my mom. I think we all responded in different ways to my dad passing, but my mom and my sister always kind of, you know, they had more of a combative relationship. And I was like, I couldn't have hung on to my mom harder, almost to the point, like sometimes I think I like would physically hug her too hard. Like she'd be like, Savannah, like you're almost like too much, you know? And I kind of remember almost being like hurt by that a little bit. Like she just couldn't handle the amount of just how much I needed her. It was like too, it was almost too much for her to bear. And so, you know, but I mean, I don't mean to make myself sound like a basket case, but that's like, I think what was going on with me internally. So when it was time to leave, not only it was hard for me to leave my mom, I felt a lot of guilt about leaving her alone.
Sure.
And the most important thing she ever did for me was she said, Savannah, if you can't leave me, then I didn't do my job right.
Yeah. That's good parenting right there.
It is, because ultimately it was sacrificial. Yeah. Because there's nothing she wouldn't have wanted more than just to have me hang around and be there and hang out with her and have a glass of wine with her and do, you know, and be her best friend, which is I would have liked to be too. If she had held on to me, if she had indicated at all, because I was scared to death to leave, go try to be a TV reporter and move to a place I'd never lived, let alone by myself, you know, not knowing a soul.
That was a loving, like, you go. That was a loving act.
Yes.
Yeah. And then you ended up coming home in 10 days.
Hilariously. She drove me up. She helped me get myself all set. It was a one-man band job, shoot your own stuff, reporter, weekend anchor, Butte, Montana. It was an NBC station, you know, owned by, mm-hmm. That was the affiliate. Newsroom staff of four, of which I was one quarter. And I moved all my stuff up there, started work. I had worked a few days, and then they called a staff meeting, which is hilarious because it was like six people. And they're like, we are closing the station. And I was shocked and devastated because I was like, it was just awful.
Well, it's like charging up San Juan Hill and then rolling down again.
Totally, because, it's, you know, I was paid $12,000 a year. It was this sort of nothing job. But I was lucky to get it. I had been sending out tapes for 6 months and never hearing a word. I was thrilled to have that job. And now that was my big chance. And then also it was embarrassing to turn around and come right back home. And then also I'd kind of spent the money I had moving, going up there. So then I was like kind of, oh my goodness, now how am I going to get going again? And so it was hard in that moment, but I just came home, sent out a few more tapes, and about actually by luck, a month later, got a job in Columbia, Missouri, which I consider my real first job in TV.
And you had you went from there to Washington.
Well, no, I went from there to Tucson. I went back to Tucson and I anchored and reported for Channel 4 in Tucson. Yeah, for like 4 years or something. And then I had the big, should I go to law school? Then that was my moment when I was decided to leave TV and go to law school.
And why did you do that? I mean, you admitted to being a high school slacker.
Yes.
And you decide, I've got this TV career and I'm going to law school.
Yes. Well, I should give the update to the slacker. Around halfway through college, I like suddenly something clicked for me. I think it was taking journalism classes and being excited about that and getting some encouragement from professors and feeling like, wait, who'd say, you're a good writer, you know? And, you know, it's like sometimes that's just all it takes. Someone saying like, you're kind of good at that. Yeah. And you're like, I want to keep doing that. You're just going to keep trying and trying. And that happened to me.
Why, by the way, did you choose broadcast journalism?
Well, that's funny. I wanted to be a print reporter. In fact, my journalism degree was 100% print. I had a bunch of old journalism professors who really turned their nose up at broadcast. You know, they did not consider those real reporters at all.
As I'm sure an old print guy, yes.
You know, you were, I can see it in your eye.
Yes, but in retrospect, I think you probably made the right decision.
I guess so, but my big dream then was to be a reporter or writer for Newsweek or Time. Mm-hmm. I loved the way those long form pieces were written, and I really aspired to write like that. But I had to get a job, and I ended up finding a part-time job at the TV station, the PBS station at the University of Arizona. So I worked there 3 years. So I kind of started learning about TV. By the end, I had convinced the news director there to let me do a few pieces, a few stories, which were terrible, but he let me do it.
But you had tapes.
So I had a tape. Yeah. You know, and as you know, as a journalist, it's like you have to have clips.
Right.
Those were my clips.
Yeah.
And so it was just kind of, I mean, I also liked it, of course, but it was more just like, I have more to offer here. I have better for a tape to send around than I do have newspaper clips.
Yeah. So what? Why law school?
Well, I started as a local reporter, both in Missouri and then in Arizona, covering courts and legal things a lot. And I started to really like it. I'm embarrassed to say this, but it was around the time of the OJ trial, and I was like obsessed with court TV and obsessed.
You weren't the only one.
I know. And so I was really into just learning about legal things, and so that was part of it. And then I was also kind of just tired of local news. I was tired of running around. I mean, like, oh, you know, this cat fell out of a tree, or you just get kind of cynical. You know how like lots of us reporters are always complaining and, you know, we think this or that is a drag. So I had a bad attitude. In a way, I was just getting kind of over it. There was that. And then the fourth thing was I knew it was really time for me to try to get a job in a bigger market. And if I'm honest with myself, I really think I wasn't sure I was good enough. And I couldn't bear the idea of sending tapes around and getting rejected. I just was like, ugh. I just knew, you know, because my hair never looked right, you know, I just didn't.
Yeah, I have the same problem.
See, hair is very important in our business. You know, but like, I mean, I have some really funny stories about that. But I just thought, I'll never get one of those big jobs. And so I decided as kind of a safety, I'll take that LSAT, and the scores are good for 3 years, and I'll have it in the back of my pocket. So in a year, when my contract here is up, I'll have that as an option to maybe think about going to law school. So that was in December 1998. I took the LSAT. The scores come back. All the deadlines to apply for law school pass. As it happens, I then, right about a month later in February, have a terrible, traumatic breakup with a boyfriend. So I'm like reeling. Like, it was just awful. You know, it was a really bad situation. And I got a letter in the mail in the midst of this in February of 1999 from Georgetown Law School.
Yeah.
And it stated, that our deadlines have passed, but we've received your LSAT score.
You must have killed it on the LSAT.
I did well, but I wasn't like Doogie Howser level, like 100%, but I did well, you know, and I had a decent grade at the University of Arizona. I think I ended up with like a 3.8 or something. So I had good grades. So that's all they had about me. I have to think now that there must have been some like admissions thing, like we need people from the Southwest. Like, how do they just send a cold call letter like that? Or back to the faith discussion. I don't know. The letter came and it said, we'll extend the deadline to March 1st and invite you to apply. And I felt like, okay, that's a sign from the universe to pluck me out of my misery here. And I cobbled together an application in 2 weeks, got the recommendations, all that stuff, sent it off. And in mid-March, I got a letter from Georgetown. You're accepted.
And you crushed it there.
Well, I mean, that's the crazy thing. You know, I had no idea. I was terrified to go. I decided to go. I left my job. My folks let me out of the contract. Actually, this is like one of my favorite stories to tell because I hope it helps people who might be listening. I was still hemming and hawing about, like, should I go to law school? Should I not? But then maybe I'll never get back into TV. And I don't know if I want, you know, I might have dreams of TV. You know, I was just hemming and hawing and hemming and hawing for myself. And I asked a guy who had worked in local news, but he was kind of an adjunct professor and I had taken his class. And I said, you know, I gave him all the particulars on the one hand, on the other hand. And he looked at me and he said, Savannah, think big. And I don't know why, because it's such a bumper sticker, but what I realized he was saying to me is, think big for yourself. Don't say, I won't be able to do this, that. So I went home and I thought.
Yeah, you had a lot of professors and teachers who were a big influence on you.
Big time. Yeah. And it made me think, I'll dream my biggest dream. And what is my biggest dream? I don't have to tell anyone, because I, you know, it would be like, I wouldn't want to be showy, but if I just told myself, what do you wish you could do?
And what was it?
It was, I would like to be a legal correspondent for a national network.
Wow.
That's what it was. And when I knew that, and I admitted that to myself, I thought, well, I guess I better go to law school.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I decided.
Yeah. And as I said, you did very well there. You top honors. And I have in my notes, I didn't know that they graded like this, but it says Guthrie scored the highest of 634 people who took the Arizona bar exam.
That just makes me a dork because it is a pass-fail test. That was like a great moment because I remember waking up in the middle of the night. I was actually here in New York to check the scores. I don't know, it must have been posting. I don't know when it posted, but I'm sitting at this table looking in the computer and I'm getting ready because I want to scroll down. It's alphabetical. I'm going to scroll down to get to see Guthrie. Did I pass? It's like October 5th. I can remember it. And before I even scroll, it says at the top, Savannah Clark Guthrie got the number one score on the Arizona bar exam. And it's the middle of the night. I have like no one to talk to. I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm dying. I can't believe it. And this is really weird, but it must have been early in the morning or something. I went out to go get a cup of coffee. I was like on the Upper West Side in New York. And this has never happened before or since, so take it with a grain. I'm waiting in the line. And all of a sudden, I just had this feeling come over me. And I looked back because I knew that my father was standing there. I knew it.
Yeah.
I was like, it was so powerful, and it was, I don't know. And when I thought about it, I was like, oh man, well, you know, maybe he saw.
Yeah.
He would have been proud because he always never thought I worked real hard. So he would have been proud to know I studied my butt off.
Yeah. That must have been a moment.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you practiced law for a couple of years, white collar defense law at Akin Gump, which is a very prominent.
Well, you know who my boss was.
Firm. Who's that?
John Dowd.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, that's, I did all my cases for him. Little known fact, I worked for him,
yeah,
and only him.
Later to become famous as
President Trump's
lawyer for,
yes,
a while. Have
he
you
used to,
have you kept in touch with,
yeah,
him?
Yeah, of course. And he used to yell at me like down the hall, Guthrie, get down here, you know, and then I would pretend that I didn't hear. And then one day he walked by, he goes, you know, I know that you can hear me when I'm yelling for you. I'm like, I'm sorry. I just, you know.
So did, yeah, you, were you surprised when he took that job, and were you surprised when he quit?
No. I wasn't surprised by any of it.
Mm-hmm.
By any of it. I mean, he's a real character and he has a lot in common with Trump. Certainly political views, and a lot of, in terms of approach as well. And he's very colorful.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, in some ways, they're very alike, but then I wasn't surprised that...
That can also set up a clash down,
right,
the line.
Right. I kind of saw it all.
Strong personalities.
Yes, yes.
And you did that for a couple of years, but you knew you wanted to get back into TV, and you went to court TV for a few years.
Yes.
Covered, what, Martha Stewart's,
yeah,
trial.
Yeah, Michael Jackson. It was actually kind of, it was a perfect
Scooter
time to
Libby.
Be there. Scooter Libby, I covered that. That's when I first ran into Patrick Fitzgerald. And,
yes, the former U.S. attorney from...
Yes.
Chicago, who was the special counsel in that.
Yeah, and that's really my first before
Were you surprised when the president pardoned Scooter Libby?
Kind of, yeah, kind of. I mean, President Bush didn't pardon him. He commuted his sentence. If anybody was going to do it, I mean, Dick Cheney begged Bush to pardon Scooter
was
Libby.
Was it an appropriate pardon, you think?
I don't know. Just remember, you're not supposed to ask me any of, like, political opinions. I don't know. I haven't looked at the pardon application. Okay. How's that for a White House response?
I'm glad your legal training is still useful.
That was Robert Gibbs circa 2009 right there I just gave you.
Well, that advances the story because you went to NBC. And the first time that I met you was when I was doing Obama's campaign. And you suddenly appeared one day.
That's right. Literally, I can remember when I first met you. You were kind of famous because you were the senior advisor to Senator Obama then, and they threw me onto the campaign, and I was like, it was after the convention. So, because I had just started at NBC, and I was a general assignment reporter. I wasn't covering politics. And then they decided, hey, why don't you go to the convention?
And you did a little work on Palin as well, right?
Well, right. I was supposed to be there. The original idea was, okay, go do the Democratic convention, and then you can be on the Biden plane, and you are going to cover Biden. So I'm like, great. I'm reading his book, Promises to Keep. Mm-hmm. I'm ready to go. I'm on the – then remember, as you sure do, that the Obama-Biden
team – we were on the runway.
You guys went on the plane together for a few days. Then there was, right after the convention, you guys took the show on the road. Then there was some kind of hurricane and the Republican convention. Remember all that?
Yes.
And then Palin got picked. And I'll never forget it. We were down at the Fairmont in Chicago on Tuesday night of the Republican convention. And I got a call. I was with, I just met Athena and some of the, those Jeff Zeleny and all those guys. Like, I'm ready to become buddies with them. And we're going to watch the convention. And I get a call from my boss. You need to be in Wasilla, Alaska by prime time tomorrow night. I'm like, what? My head's exploding. And then I was on the Palin plane the rest of the time. So I never saw you again.
Yes. Well, we reunited. But Palin, just a word on her. What were your impressions?
Well, it's interesting because we were on the plane, but there was so little interaction with her, and I wouldn't blame that on her. I think she wasn't one to come back to the back of the plane and chit chat. When she first started, she was like this big sensation.
Yeah.
Then, of course, I was there in Alaska when the Katie Couric interview happened.
Which was a disaster for her.
So I really didn't have a ton of interaction with her, even though I was on her plane, which my mom always, ever the sensible one, was like, I don't understand why you're following her around the country if you never speak to her. I'm like, good,
good
point,
question,
Mom.
Yes.
I know.
She should have written a strong note to the campaign about
I know.
That. You went on to become a White House correspondent.
Yes.
Tell me about that experience and what that I often think the White House beat is maybe the worst beat in government because you guys are so tethered down there, you're penned in, and you're so reliant on feeds from the administration that there's not a lot of, but you have to cover it all.
Yes.
So not a lot of time for enterprise journalism.
There isn't. I mean, it's a certain.
Of course, we didn't leak quite the way this
White House
does.
No, unfortunately, you didn't. Darn you.
Not for lack of trying.
I mean, the whole experience of covering the White House was like, it was like getting another graduate degree because I had never really covered politics, but I had to show up. And what I didn't know about politics, I knew if I worked really hard and prepped really hard. Like the advice I kind of gave to myself was I could try to be deep on policy and hopefully earn the respect of people like you, so that you would return my call. And that if I could
You did do that.
I tried. Yeah. That's what I had to do. I didn't have one source in the Obama administration, not one. And Chuck was my partner. Mm-hmm. And Chuck and Robert were very
Chuck
tight.
God,
Everybody knew Chuck, And so I never wanted to lean on Chuck or say, hey, can you tell me what they said? Mm-hmm. I was like, the hell I would ever do that. Like, yes. I got to enterprise my own stuff, And so I had to, it was ultimately good, but I had to work hard. And every day I woke up feeling like I was behind, trying to catch up. But I loved it. It's the most challenging job there is. I still think it's the hardest job in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to denigrate it's an incredible thing to be at the sort of apex of power. But as a journalist, I was a City Hall bureau chief.
Yeah.
And when you're tied to a building, and particularly that building, because everything's so so locked down, you know?
Yeah, it's a certain kind of journalism. It's like not the thing that I wanted to do in college when I wanted to be a news reporter and write some like mellifluous story about like, you know, I don't know, like migrant birds and South Africa or whatever. Like,
first time anybody's used the word mellifluous on this podcast.
Well, and by the way,
250 podcasts or something in 240 some podcasts.
I almost didn't stick the landing. It's very hard. There's a reason people don't say it. They write it. They don't say it.
That's why you're a big time network talent. So you and Chuck did a show on MSNBC, the Daily Rundown, I think it was called.
Yes, we did.
And that by the way, during that show, isn't that when you first encountered Donald Trump as a subject? I think you kind of grilled him on Roe versus Wade, which seemed to be unfamiliar turf for him.
I did, but I can't believe you remember that. Nobody remembers that. Whoever your researchers are on this show, let's talk about a job.
Big shout out to them.
Yeah, yes. Seriously. But no, I did, because actually I remember I was still at the White House and we would talk to Trump would sometimes call us because, you know, he was sort of flirting with Iran. This is 2011. He would call Chuck and I after the show and be kind of mad that, not really me so much because I'm not really one to offer an opinion, hopefully, but, you know,
now,
Chuck
did he
is,
call as himself or John Barron
John Miller? As himself and say, you know, could be kind of mad that we'd been dismissive or whatever. And sometimes, like, his office, and maybe even Michael Cohen, maybe not, I don't know, somebody from the office, I remember once sending me Apprentice ratings. And I thought, I thought it was the funniest thing. I'm like, why are you sending TV ratings as the evidence of political viability? Mm-hmm. Cut to when we're in 2018, who would have ever thought? But yes, I did sit down with him. I did an interview with him. And I had no idea. Somebody else at the Today Show was supposed to do it. And Jim Bell, who was the EP then, called me right after the Daily Rundown. I was in Washington. It was 10 a.m. And he's like, can you come to New York and interview Donald Trump this afternoon?
Mm.
And I was like, what? What about? Yeah, okay. So I jumped on a plane, scribbled down a bunch of questions. Okay, I'll just ask him everything. And yeah, we had a
lot. But you asked him about the right to privacy relative to abortion, which is sort of at the center of Roe versus Wade. And he was...
Yeah, so it was interesting. The reason I was asking was because he was a somewhat recent convert
from pro-choice to pro-life.
Yes, exactly. And so I was kind of trying to probe, like, you know, how genuine are those beliefs, or is this something that was politically expedient because now you're a Republican? And so I wanted to see if he kind of knew where the hot buttons were. So I asked if there's a right to privacy in the Constitution. He said, yeah, I would say there is. And then he said, why do you ask? And then it was kind of funny because I in that moment, I'm like, well, I don't want to give away the answer, you know, like, but I don't want to be like I'm trying to play tricks or something. So I said, well, I just gave a hint. I said, you know, I just wondered how that squares with your pro-life position.
Yeah. And he said, so that's a pretty strange way of getting to.
Yeah. Pro-life. He's like, I don't know what has to do with the other. Yeah. And then I finally told him, well, the right to privacy is very controversial. It's the underpinning of the decision in Roe versus Wade. He was like, oh. And then this, I can't remember. I wish I had that. I never put this on TV, which I think shows that I'm like, I don't know. I probably should have. I wish I still had it. But he said something like, well, I don't know what you're talking about. And I don't think you know what you're talking about either.
Yeah. Well, that's a very Trumpian exchange.
Yes, but I didn't put that. Where he insulted me, I didn't put that. And I didn't say, well, you know, I went to Georgetown Law School.
Yeah, and finished first on my bar exam in Arizona.
I just left it all on the cutting room floor.
And then you got promoted to the Today Show.
Yes.
I remember this day. I happened to be here in July of 2012, the day after you were announced as replacing Ann Curry.
Yeah.
And I remember I was so, you know, as a friend, I was proud of you, and I saw you, and you said to me, this is really, really a hard day because of all of the kind of drama around Ann Curry leaving and this sense that you were usurping her chair. Yeah.
I didn't want that.
Yeah. You said, this isn't the way I wanted this job.
Yeah, it was really hard. I mean, that was definitely, it was just so complicated. I was really thrown into that situation. I think my bosses were trying to protect me by telling me nothing, literally nothing about what was going on. I was the anchor of the 9 o'clock and the legal correspondent. And so I was kind of connected. You know, I was part of the Today Show, but I was sort of like off in my own little happy land. And, you know, I just felt all of it. I just could see right away how fraught everything was, you know, and Anne was a friend. You know, we got to ready together every day, you know, and so, you know, like I felt terrible about that. And then I also felt, frankly, scared and worried for myself because I thought, oh, I'm like the transitional
right,
figure
that
that's going to be gone in
well,
6 months.
Well, that was the, you know, the kind of storyline then was like, will viewers view you as the, you know, you the young woman who pushed, because this is, the weird thing about these morning shows, I guess any show,
yeah,
is it's a casting and there are dynamics and people look at you as a family, which is something that NBC has promoted and other shows promote the same thing. So here now there's a breakup in the family.
Yeah, and viewers, I mean, they feel connected to us and we feel connected to them. And it is like a strange thing because morning shows, it's like you're kind of, in essence, you're spending your morning together. So people do feel, and I want them, well, I think we want them to feel that way. Right. I feel that way about them. Like we're all just in this together. So it's like, was so hard for them, the viewer, and then it was hard for everyone here. And it's just complicated and, you know, and then I was just sad about everything and scared. And of course it's like, you know, you want to be, say like, oh my gosh, like this is amazing. This is like the dream of a lifetime, but it didn't feel that way at all because I really didn't, I was pretty sure it probably wasn't going to work out that well for me. I kind of felt like, you know what? I even said to my then boss at the time, I said, why don't you just have me fill in for 6 months? You don't have to give me the job. You could just, because I was like, well, then maybe people will know. And then if they make a change, it won't like ruin. I thought like, oh my gosh, and then it'll be a career ender. And I was so happy at the 9 o'clock. Like I felt like I worked all this way to get here and now it's going to go back to zero. And you don't have to do that. You know, it'll be okay, but I'll be happy to fill in. But, you know, in the end, thankfully it worked out and I've loved all my years here.
It worked out, but then there was this other trauma, which is the Matt Lauer story.
Yeah.
We're sitting here in your office. You still have photos of yourself and Matt.
That was my first day. That picture back there. That's the very first day.
And so you obviously were close. You worked well together. Were you stunned?
Yes.
When the hammer fell on him for improprieties that involved women?
I was. I really was. I was stunned and I was heartbroken. And, you know, in a lot of ways, I still am. And
you keep in touch with him?
I try. Yeah, I do try, you know. You know, it's just like this is such a strange time in our society. And it's like I don't have any great answers. And of course, I'm, you know, whenever you talk about any of this stuff, you tiptoe all around it because I don't want to like offend anyone or say the wrong thing. But so I'm just trying to just kind of like navigate it with as much integrity as I can and honesty and transparency. And
so,
I was surprised and stunned and
Savannah, you know,
upset.
Ann Curry has said that women came to her. Did women come to you?
Never. Never.
Mm-hmm.
Never.
So you had no reason to suspect that anything was going
on.
No,
I didn't. I didn't.
And you kind of found out in the middle of the night.
Literally the middle of the night, they called me.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So it's, it was shocking. You know? So it's like you work with someone and the day before they're there and the next day they're not. And it was getting that phone call in the middle of the night and it was like 4 o'clock in the morning and then we didn't know hardly anything. You know, what I said on the air that morning was all I knew. And in fact, we had to repeat something at 8 o'clock and I read something that didn't even know. I read it cold. I was like, oh, this happened in 2014. You know, I was kind of shocked that I thought if there's something there, when they first called me, I thought if there's something there, it's from the olden days. It's from like the bygone era of like, oh, there must have been a time, you know, like when you work in newsrooms, there's always like the old like, oh, remember those days?
Yes, right.
You know, like I worked in a newsroom in D.C. and they'd be like, oh, yeah, the crew guys used to drink beer at lunch, you know, or whatever. Like I felt like, oh, it's going to be one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And when I heard that it was recent, I was like, I was truly stunned, you know. I was at the Olympics. Like
this is one of the incidents that was involved.
Yeah.
What happened at the Olympics?
Yeah. So I didn't know what to say, and I didn't know anything about the nature of the allegations or who the person was, and you know, I had to write something. Me and Hoda had to sit there and try to just write something, and I don't know. I just did the best I could.
This may be an unfair question, given the fact that that we're sitting here in your office at NBC. Do you think NBC handled that well? Were they quick enough to take action on the one hand? Were they fair to him on the other?
Gosh, I mean, that's such a complicated question, you know? I mean, and I do work for NBC, so I'm sure people
want to keep it that way.
Yeah, yeah, right? You can't cost me a job or else I'll get a job as a researcher. You should see my research skills. You know, I think the NBC acted quickly based on the information it had that was credible information. And as I understand it, Matt understood that with their position. And I think they took the right action. And I think they didn't have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it doesn't mean that it wasn't heart-wrenching, and it doesn't mean that I'm like unsympathetic to all concerned. I am. I mean, life is like, if anything in my faith
have you
teaches
experienced
me, it's
those...
just like how messy everything is, you know, and my heart goes out to everybody.
Have you experienced harassment as you came up in this business?
You know, it's funny. I have talked about that a lot with friends and thought about it. My mom's asked me, has anything like that ever happened to you? You know, and I think generally I would say no. However, I think we all have an evolving understanding of what is really okay in the workplace. And, you know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, when I was 21 years old and starting out, like the kind of things that, you know, a guy like flirting with you or a boss, like you just were like, that was just life. You know, it's just like I never felt harassed or in any way felt like I couldn't do my job or that I wasn't respected. I mean, I'm very grateful that I never felt I encountered a workplace situation that prevented me from trying to just have a peaceful, productive working environment, which many women cannot say the same. You know, they haven't had the opportunity to just have I keep saying the word peaceful, but just a work environment where they could just do their jobs. But certainly, like, if I really racked my brain and thought about it, yeah, I'm sure there have been moments over the years. But happily, nothing that rose to the level where it would stick out in my mind.
What do you make of the whole Me Too movement that's grown here?
I am supportive of women coming forward, telling their stories. I hope that it's like everything in our society right now is, now it sounds like a cliche, but it's like, it's so tribalistic, you know? And I think everybody's in their corners, and some things are really black and white, you know? It's like Harvey Weinstein. I mean, that is just... I know he's innocent until proven guilty, but the allegations there are incredibly disturbing.
Yeah.
You know.
By the way, that was a story. Ronan Farrow just picked up a Pulitzer Prize yesterday for that. He was working on that story here, and why didn't they run that story?
You know, I don't have any more insight into it than what I think NBC has said publicly. But my understanding is that NBC felt at the moment that, I guess some critical moment where the decision had to be made, I don't know the details, that NBC felt that what he had at that moment did not meet its broadcast standards. I don't know what it was. I really don't know what went into that decision, you know?
Could also be that Harvey Weinstein was he was a powerful figure in entertainment.
Yeah, I know. And I know people kind of say that. I think NBC takes on powerful people all journalists do if they're good. I mean, like, that's what we're here to do. And in fact, I think it was NBC that commissioned the story with Ronan and was supporting his reporting. So it doesn't make a lot of sense, like, to lose their nerve at the last second. So again, you know, I'm not trying to circle the wagons around my employer. You know, I still have free speech, so I could say what I think, but I certainly don't even feel I have the sufficient information to even make a judgment call. Like, do I know? I don't know what they were looking at. You know, Ronan is a great reporter, and the proof is in the pudding. And mm-hmm. 6 weeks later, or 8 weeks later, or whatever it was, 2 months, he got a story in the New Yorker, and, you know,
changed the course of history.
It deserves the Pulitzer, as does the New York Times reporting.
Absolutely.
Those women deserve the Pulitzer, and it's important. It matters, and it, like, created an earthquake, you know? And I think all of that is good, you know? And I don't mean to give a cop-out or, like, you
no,
know.
No.
It would be irresponsible for me to weigh in on the editorial decision that was made. And I want to at least give my employers the benefit of the doubt that they wouldn't just sit on a Pulitzer Prize-winning story and go, nah.
You know, you said earlier, you made a reference to hair. And and it made me think about the different standards that are applied to women and men in broadcast journalism, because people have to, you know, people watch and everything is judged and so on. And do you think women and men are judged by the same standard?
Probably not. It would be nice if they were, but, you know, I think, I doubt that we're judged by the same standard. But then, you know, I think there's just unfairness all over the place. But also, I mean, it's just, you know, so women, yes, are we judged on our appearances? Yes. Are men judged because if they're manly enough, or, you know, are they allowed to cry at the office? You know, I mean, I think there's all kinds, you could go in a lot of different directions.
Do you think the half-life of women in your role is shorter than others?
I would say absolutely. I don't know. I see a lot of really hardworking, kick-ass women such as Andrea Mitchell, who is proudly, I think, 72, which blows my mind. The woman has more energy, stamina. It's ridiculous.
We spent some time with her a few months ago.
She's incredible, and she is out there breaking stories, you know, and there's a lot of example. I mean, Judy Woodruff. You're going to get me in trouble with my colleagues because some of them will say, wait, are you saying I'm an older woman? But they're a little older than me. But now I'm one of the older women.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm 46 years old and all of our correspondents are younger than me.
But
I know. Yes. But now I'm middle aged. So, you know, I kind of think I feel there's been so much progress in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
I really do.
Well, let me just say this as a friend. I so appreciate you, and I appreciate your openness, and I think one of the reasons why you're so successful is not just that you're bright and talented, but that you're real and you're authentic, and people read that, and they appreciate it, and I sure do.
Thank you.
So it's great to be with you.
Thank you. I'm so proud of you, my fellow member of the media.
Yes, thank you.
Remember when you used to complain about the media?
Yes, I know. That's all in the past. Thanks, Savannah.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. For more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.